I understand.
Here we go. You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Hello, comrades. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and I stand by what I said in last week's show that anti-colonialism, resistance against colonialism, the overthrow of colonialism remains the chief political task of our time. I said that last week. Last week, I was talking about Burnaby, BC, and the hundreds of people who were willing to get arrested to stop the construction of the Kinder Morgan pipeline on stolen native land. I talked about the solidarity march we had in Guelph 1 week ago, led by Fossil Free Guelph, where we took the street, marched on the MP's office, and made our voices heard, while making the point loud and clear that environmental justice and the struggle against settler colonialism in this country are not separate issues. They're hand in hand. Because whose land, whose livelihood is threatened when pipelines leak? Whose children are poisoned when tar sands bitumen gets into the aquifers and watersheds? It's overwhelmingly the indigenous peoples of this land who suffer the consequences of fossil fuel expansion and the drive, the escalating drive for profit. It's the same thing in countries like Ecuador, where indigenous peoples are still living with the mess that Chevron created in its relentless pursuit of oil profits in the Ecuadorian rainforest. Where indigenous people are suffering skyrocketing rates of cancer while the oil giant continues to refuse to pay one penny in compensation. It's the same thing in Alaska, where indigenous people are still living with the after effects of the Exxon Valdez oil spill almost 3 decades later, which practically destroyed the marine ecosystems that they relied on for their livelihoods. It's the same thing in Chile, where the indigenous Mapuche people are facing fascist police violence for protecting their land in the face of multinational mining conglomerates. It's the same thing in India and Brazil, where hundreds of thousands of indigenous people are forcibly uprooted and driven from their ancestral lands through military force to make way for power dam construction. It's the same thing in Australia, where the government actually allowed Britain, where the Australian government actually allowed Britain to test its nuclear weapons on indigenous land in the 1950s. And indigenous people are still dealing with the after effects of that. And it's the same thing in the United States, where the lands of the Navajo people remain contaminated by the radioactive effects of uranium mining, and where Black American communities are disproportionately situated alongside toxic waste dumps and highly polluting industrial sites, not unlike the indigenous people who live in Sarnia's Chemical Valley in Ontario. The struggle against colonialism and the struggle against capitalist environmental devastation are one and the same. They're one and the same. And this is extremely important to understand. Now, I drove this point home last week as much as I could. Last week, I also talked about Syria, where the United States is holding a full 25% of that country, including 90% of its oil reserves, under military occupation. I talked about countries like Libya, Iraq, and Yugoslavia, where, just like in Syria, the toxic effects of the American imperial war machine are being felt, from cancer-causing depleted uranium to a whole host of other leftovers that have had the effect of poisoning the air, the water, and the soil. Really, the entire ecosystem that people rely on. The entire food chain. And I talked about Vietnam, where the toxic effects of Dow Chemical's Agent Orange, defoliant, are being felt to this day, where the cancer rates is one of the highest in the world, and where the ecosystem remains tainted by the byproducts of imperialist war almost 50 years ago, ended 50 years ago, and yet you're still seeing the after effects of that, and we'll continue seeing the after effects of that for decades, maybe even centuries to come. And you can also see it in places like Puerto Rico, U.S. colony, where for decades the U.S. Navy poisoned the island of Vieques with toxic munitions testing, and were only forced to stop by a massive protest movement among local people who had suffered birth defects and runaway cancer rates, and whose livelihoods had also been devastated. So when the apartheid state of Israel, the apartheid state of Israel, besieges and blockades 2 million Palestinians in the world's largest open-air prison, the Gaza Strip, forces them to live in squalor, and then shoots them down when they demonstrate for freedom, none of this should come as a surprise. Yesterday, Good Friday, March 30th, 2018, was when the colonized Palestinian people marked Land Day, which happens every March 30th. Land Day is a commemoration day remembering the murder of 6 unarmed Palestinians by Israeli forces during the 1976 strikes that were aimed at preventing the seizing of land for illegal Israeli settlements. The 1976 strikes that were aimed at preventing the seizing of Palestinian land for illegal Israeli settlements. And to mark Land Day, Palestinians in Gaza organized a series of peaceful protests along the border with Israel. And those of you who know about how militarized the border between Israel and Gaza is, you know, with guard towers, remotely controlled guard towers, drones, tanks, artillery, all kinds of stuff, all just poised on that border, ready to fire at any time. It takes no small courage to even approach. But they did. They organized a series of peaceful protests along that border. And the protests are, the plan is to have for them to be ongoing for to last 6 weeks and end on the Nakba Day commemoration on May 15th, a day after the anniversary of Israel's official declaration of independence, which is remembered by the Palestinians as the catastrophe day in which they were expelled from their land by an invading army. But these protests on Land Day, which just happened yesterday, tens of thousands of Palestinians came out. They were unarmed, ready to assert their national rights in resisting colonialism. They came out and they marched peacefully. But the Israeli army was prepared well in advance of yesterday's demonstrations and had signaled its willingness to use lethal force against unarmed people. In a series of interviews published Wednesday, just 2 days before the massacre happened, IDF Chief of Staff Gadi Eisenkot said that the Palestinian Land Day protests in Gaza would be met by 100 snipers, and other special units. And he said, quote, "If there will be a danger to lives, we will authorize live fire. The orders are to use a lot of force," end quote. The occupation authorities decided to double the security forces' presence on the Gazan border to safeguard the no-go zone, fearing a mass breakout of Palestinians into Israel. And the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, started shooting live ammunition at demonstrators as soon as the demonstrations began on Friday. Israel's foreign ministry declared the protests to be, quote, "a deliberate attempt to provoke a confrontation with Israel, ignoring the rights of Gazans to protest an illegal occupation and continuous harassment of indigenous people," which they are. Early on Friday, Gazan farmer Omar Wahid Abu Samour was killed by a tank shell while working in his own land near Khan Yunis, even before the demonstration started, showing the occupation forces' true intentions. Before the demonstrations even kicked off, they had already killed someone. You know, the Israeli forces had already killed someone, shot someone dead. When the demonstrations began and thousands of unarmed Palestinians assembled to assert their rights under international law, it did not take long for the Israeli occupation troops to start shooting. True to form, the New York Times on Friday tried to frame the bloodshed as being the result of clashes, quote-unquote, between opposing sides, when in reality it was a one-sided massacre with heavily armed soldiers pitted against unarmed civilians in what became a gigantic shooting gallery. Good Friday 2018 was to be the bloodiest day in Gaza since Israel's 2014 offensive, according to the charity Medical Aid for Palestinians. At the end of the day, Palestine's health ministry reported 15 dead and 1,400, that's 1,400, injured, 773 of which were hit by live ammunition, so were shot. 773. Gaza hospitals running low on blood and overstretched by the huge number of wounded, were sent reeling after this massacre. An Israeli army posted a statement on Twitter on Saturday, today, apparently accepting full responsibility for the killings of 15 Palestinians a day earlier. The army then quickly deleted the admission as more evidence of war crimes by its soldiers came to light, but not before a copy was made by the human rights group B'Tselem. The now deleted tweet from the official IDF spokesperson account stated, quote, "Yesterday we saw 30,000 people. We arrived prepared and with precise reinforcements. Nothing was carried out uncontrolled. Everything was accurate and measured, and we know where every bullet landed." End quote. So basically admitting that Israeli soldiers shot to kill. It was not an accident. It was deliberate. It was a deliberate massacre of unarmed people. The UN has belatedly called for an independent inquiry, but it must be pointed out that last year, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, acting under US pressure, suppressed a report that condemned Israel's colonial policies against Palestinians as an example of apartheid. For its part, the EU acknowledged that Israel used, quote, "live ammunition during clashes and demonstrations," but endorsed Israel's, quote, "right to protect its borders with," quote, "proportionate force." The Palestinian Authority called for a day of national mourning in the wake of the shootings. Funeral services began with the burial of the 30-year-old Sari Abu Odeh on Friday evening. And according to Al Jazeera, other fatal victims include Mohammed Najjar, 25 years old, Mahmoud Muammar, 38, Mohammed Abu Omar, 22, Ahmed Odeh, 19, Jihad Frene, 33, Mahmoud Sadi Rahimi, 33, Abdel Fattah Abdel Nabi, 22, Ibrahim Abu Shar, 20, Abdel Qadir Al Hawajiri, Sari Abu Odeh, Hamdan Abu Amshe, Jihad Abu Jamas, Badr Al Sabag, and Naji Abu Hajar. Palestinian writer Shahad Abu Salama stated, quote, "There is no justification for suppressing people whose right to resist colonial oppression is guaranteed by international law. The fact that Israel has been able to continue this brutal violence against Palestinians with total impunity for 70 years reflects a deep-seated moral problem in our world." End quote. My response would be that deep-seated moral problems always arise from material conditions of oppression and exploitation. The struggle against colonialism remains, brothers and sisters, it remains the key political struggle of our time, and this is true all around the world. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Everybody run, run, run. Hey-ya! Everybody scatter, scatter. Hey-ya! Some people lost some bread. Hey-ya! Someone nearly died. Hey-ya! Someone just died. Hey-ya! Police, they come, army, they come. Hey-ya! Confusion everywhere. Hey-ya! 7 minutes later, all done cool down, brother. Police don't go away, army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
That is why everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Someone nearly died. Some people lost some bread. one just die. Yeah. Police, they come, army, they come. Yeah. Confusion everywhere. Yeah. 7 minutes later, all don't go down, brother. Police don't go away, army don't disappear. Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
La 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 la. My people say they fear too much. We fear for the thing we no see. We fear for the air around us. We fear to fight for freedom. We fear to fight for liberty. We fear to fight for justice. We fear to fight for happiness. We always get reason to fear. We no one die. We no one wound. We no one quench. We no one go. Get one child, my mother for house, my party for house. I won't build a house, I don't build a house. I know I won't quench, I won't enjoy, I know I won't go. So policeman go slap your face, you know go talk. Army man go weep your ass, you go they look like donkey. Rhodesia they do them own, our leaders they have for nothing. South Africa they do them own. Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
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 Regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
That is why everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Police they come, army they come. Confusion everywhere. Ah, and so time when they go. Time no wait for nobody. Like that. Ah, but police go they come. Army go they come. With confusion in style. Like this. Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come, army, they come. Confusion everywhere. 7 minutes later, all don't cool down, brother. Police don't go away. Army don't disappear. Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
Them live sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
That is why everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. That was Fela Kuti, legendary Nigerian Afrobeat singer. And of course, he was talking about, that came out in the 1970s, 1977 actually, that album, Sorrow, Tears and Blood came out. And he was talking about colonialism in Africa. And of course, he mentioned apartheid South Africa in there as well. And of course, we're still seeing colonialism cause sorrow, tears, and blood throughout the world. And we saw that very, very clearly in Gaza, what happened in Gaza on Good Friday. Now, the clip I'm about to play discusses something that is very poorly understood by Westerners. And that is the right of a colonized people to armed self-defense. To armed resistance against the colonizer. This clip is of a Jewish American scholar and Palestinian solidarity activist, Norman Finkelstein, talking recently on The Real News about his latest book, which is about the situation in Gaza. And as you'll see, he argues that armed struggle is not effective, but that the Palestinians, like any other colonized people, have the absolute right to use it under international law in order to fight for their own self-determination as a people, in order to resist colonization. Now, the counter-argument that is put to him in this interview, asks why the Palestinians in Gaza don't just engage in some kind of mass campaign of civil disobedience instead. You know, wouldn't that be more effective? You know, it wouldn't give Israel, quote, a pretext, you know, to attack Gaza, that kind of stuff. You know, because, of course, like the, you know, whenever Palestinians fight back using armed force, what the Israelis always try to use that as propaganda against the Palestinians. And, you know, that's the line of argument that this counter argument is making. Well, the massacre that happened on Good Friday, just yesterday, was indeed the answer to that counter argument that gets made in this interview. It is the answer to that. When the Israeli apartheid state is willing to deploy 100 snipers against unarmed demonstrators, engaging in an actual campaign of mass civil disobedience, and shoot 15 people dead and injure a further 773 people with live ammunition, many of them critically, we are most certainly in a situation where armed self-defense is more than justified on the part of Palestinians. And if you disagree with that, I'm sorry. You know, like, I think you're living in an alternate reality. I mean, frankly, it's one of the few ways that they have of resisting a colonial occupation that only gets more and more brutal with each passing year. I mean, keep that in mind while you're listening to this interview. Now, please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. Continuing our conversation with Norman Finkelstein, author of the new book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Let's get into this is a tough issue for many people, but you take it on, which is the morality of Hamas and all the other Palestinian factions of armed struggle. Now, you write in the book that under international law, Hamas has every right, and Hamas and all Palestinian factions, because, by the way, it's not just Hamas that uses force inside Gaza. There are several factions there. But you write that under international law, they have every right to armed resistance. Can you explain mm-hmm. that?
Well, I was pretty careful in my choice of words because I went through the scholarly literature on the subject, and the most authoritative opinions by, say, James Crawford at Oxford is that there's no law prohibiting peoples under occupation and struggling for self-determination. There's no law barring them from using armed force to gain their self-determination or to end an occupation. On the other hand, international law is very clear and unequivocal that an occupying power or a power denying a people the right to self-determination does not have the right to use armed force. Now, that raises the next level of analysis is two complications. Complication number one on the side of Hamas is, even if they have the right to use armed force, or there's no law prohibiting them, do they have the right to use weapons which are inherently indiscriminate and therefore cannot target military sites or military personnel, but will end up causing significant civilian death? So there's a question that's a secondary level of analysis. They have the right, but do they have the right to use indiscriminate weapons? On the Israeli side, they don't have the right to preserve an occupation. They don't have the right to deny a people the right to self-determination. But do they have the right to use their weapons in self-defense? That's their claim, okay? So, if you allow me, let's look at each of those questions. Question number one, Hamas's use of indiscriminate weapons. First of all, as a factual matter, let's set aside the quality of the weapons. The weapons are basically symbolic. They're the equivalent of fireworks. As Khalid Mishal put it at one point, the head of Hamas at that moment, he no longer is, he says they're our cry to the world. You know, it's a kind of, if I can use my language, it's a kind of SOS. They're sending these flares into the air, SOS, we're dying. SOS, we're dying. That's not an exaggeration. When Mary Robinson from the UN High Commission, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, when she went to Gaza in 2008, she said, a whole civilization is being destroyed. I am not exaggerating. A whole civilization is being destroyed.
Okay.
So if but you send up flares saying SOS, we're dying, which have next to zero impact on civilians, next to zero, I think whether or not they're discriminate or indiscriminate, it's beside the point. They're okay. Doing no damage. They are almost entirely symbolic.
Okay, but here's my problem with mm-hmm. that. To say that they're entirely symbolic and
almost entirely symbolic
and that's their SOS
yeah.
presumes that that's their only method of letting out an SOS.
Mm-hmm.
And firing rockets, even if they're futile, is not the only way. I mean, you've pointed this out, mm-hmm. that they could engage if they wanted, they could organize a mass nonviolent campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But you write in the book this, you say the ultimate question is, do Palestinians have the right to symbolically resist slow death, punctuated by periodic massacres, or is it incumbent upon them to lie down and die? But why are those the only two options? I mean, why is an option, instead of exercising their symbolic right to resist, why is not, instead of directing your energies towards that, towards violence, in the case of Hamas, directing it towards organizing mass nonviolence? How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I'm not a moral coward. And as I said at the beginning of the book, I've never taken foundation money, not that it was ever offered me, but I don't take the foundation money. And that's a kind of, or think tank money, or even university money. So it's a kind of a liberatory experience. If he who pays the piper calls the tune, nobody's paying this piper, so I get to call my own tune. And so I just want to look at the facts. Nobody has the right to tell Palestinians that they should practice nonviolence. I think it's a losing strategy, the strategy of armed resistance. And I've said it many times to them. Occasionally I do seminars over Skype with people in Gaza. And I'm very forthright about that. I said, it's just a mythology. There's no armed resistance. It's just something Israel exploits each time it launches one of its massacres. But there's a difference between telling them, I don't think this strategy is going to work, and telling them they don't have the right. The law is clear.
I got that. I'm not
they
saying,
have the right.
I got that.
I'm not going to tell them they have to practice nonviolence. Gandhi did not do that. During the first Arab Rebellion in Palestine in 1936 to 38, he had a very heated exchange, you might say an unfriendly exchange, with Martin Buber, the so-called pacifist Zionist philosopher. And he said to Buber, well, I think it was initially, it began with an interview that Gandhi gave. He said, I wish the Palestinians choose nonviolence. But then he went on to say, according to the accepted canons, C-A-N-O-N-S, according to the accepted canons of right and wrong, he didn't say Palestinians at that point, Arabs have the right to use armed force to resist their aggressors, their occupation. So I am dealing here in the book with the law. And under the law, they have no obligation to lie down and die. They have no obligation to do that under the law. They have the right to resist, and they have the right to use force in their resistance. Now, you know, Gandhi advocated for the Jews during World War II, during the height of the Nazi Holocaust. He said they should have gone nonviolently. He says that. I have mixed feelings about what he says there, but now is not the time to get into that. He's been very violently attacked for what he said about the Jews should have gone quietly to their death. The point I'm making is, but does anybody tell the people in Warsaw not to have engaged in an uprising?
Well, the difference
does anybody
there, though,
tell
the difference
them,
there
does
though, is that it wouldn't have mattered what the Jews in World War II did anyway. They would have been forced to the ovens no matter what.
Yeah, but nobody denies them the right.
Oh, of course not. Listen, that's not the point. The point of contention here is that the only Hamas's two choices are not lie down and die.
It's politically inexpedient what they're doing.
Yeah.
I have no doubt
about
that.
And they're still responsible for the consequences of...
No, they're not responsible.
Of their decisions. Yes, they are.
They are politically responsible. They're not legally responsible.
Okay.
And they're not morally responsible. They have the right. They have that right, and they reserve that. And the law is they have the right. Now, there is the question, as I said, the weapons are indiscriminate. Technically, it's illegal under international law. In my opinion, as I said, their effectiveness is almost entirely symbolic. Number two, there's a second aspect. And here it's the only place in the book where I do disagree with international law. Well, there are, you know, one place. There's another place where I have a partial reservation. And the problem is this, and I'm sure you'll understand it, it's perfectly obvious. What does it mean to say a weapon is indiscriminate? What does that mean? A weapon can't be objectively indiscriminate. It can only be relatively indiscriminate. As compared to another weapon, this weapon is indiscriminate. But in and of itself, a weapon can't be indiscriminate, because a weapon in 1940, which would have been described as discriminate, in 2010, it's described as indiscriminate.
Okay.
Why? Because technology has improved, and what seemed to be discriminate 50 years ago now seems indiscriminate, because we have what's called precision weapons.
Right. So your point here is that if Hamas wasn't occupied, they would be in a position to access precision weapons. Unfortunately, because of their position.
Or if they weren't poor.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It discriminates against poor, it discriminates, these laws discriminate against poorly endowed fighters, and richly endowed fighters get to conduct wars. So then, where does that leave us? It leaves us in a kind of ridiculous argument or a ridiculous conclusion. It really is a case of a reductio ad absurdum. So you have the human rights organizations, for example, the UN Human Rights Council. What do they say to Hamas? Well, they say, Hamas, you can't fight in densely populated areas, which is not the law, incidentally, but let's leave that aside. So you should go to non-densely populated areas, basically vacant areas of Gaza. There are a couple, you know, a few vacant areas. Now, go to the vacant areas, but you can't use any of your weapons because your mortars are indiscriminate and your so-called rockets are indiscriminate. So you can't use any of your weapons. Now you have a problem. As John Dugard, the leading authority in international law on the Israel-Palestine conflict, as
jurist from South Africa.
Yeah, South Africa. Yeah. He's called the father of human rights in South Africa, an extremely principled, a very special human being, but that's another story. John Dugard says, we have an unusual situation here. We have an occupation that's externally maintained. Mm-hmm. Israel occupies by virtue of the fact that it controls the airspace, the sea space, the borders. So, but it's all external. It's by remote control. So, you have to go to vacant spaces, says UN Human Rights Council. You can't use those rockets. You can't use the mortars because they're indiscriminate weapons, and we can only use precision weapons. And then how do you fight an external occupation? You can't do it. So in effect, you're saying Palestinians don't have any right to armed self-defense. Then just be honest about it.
No,
you don't have that right because you're not rich enough to afford precision weapons. You don't have that right. The only thing that wasn't recommended to them, it's not just Hamas, it's the whole population. The only thing that's not recommended to them is they should line up like ducks to be shot down by Israeli planes and rockets. That, to me, is a reductio ad absurdum.
I get it. You're pointing to the hypocrisy and the... It's totally hypocritical, and it's a flagrant double standard. Mm-hmm. There's no argument there. I guess the point of contention here is, again, even though Hamas is representing an occupied people, mm-hmm. and occupied people have every legal right to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm. Armed force to defend themselves.
To use armed force. My concern is conflating legal rights with morality. And morality includes being responsible for the consequences of your actions. So if you know, even if you have every right to launch rockets or to authorize the launching of rockets or to allow it to happen, if you know it's going to provoke a response, mm-hmm. I guess even though we're sitting here in the West, we don't live under occupation, do we have the right to say to criticize Hamas?
But Aaron, you're really mixing cause and effect. You say it's going to provoke a response. They were provoked into responding.
But
it's Israel that breaks the ceasefires. They were provoked responding.
Right.
And then what are they supposed to do?
They don't have to fire rockets. They don't have to.
And you know what? I wish they didn't. I do, because I do believe it plays into Israel's hands. However, I will never criticize them for it. And you know why?
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you why. Because the people support it. And I'm not going to tell those people. If the people were to condemn Hamas, and right now there does seem to be a strong sentiment, they want to avoid at any cost another Israeli attack. So if Hamas were to attack now, in violation of the will of the people of Gaza, I would oppose it.
You're confident that
When Israel is attacking them, yes, they do. There's no question about that. Exactly as what happened in Lebanon when Israel attacked in 2006. Even though Lebanon is a very divided country. But when the attack occurred, all the polls showed 70-80% of the people of Lebanon supported their country when it was coming under a foreign invasion by these marauders, these vandals, this Mongol army. Of course they supported them, and it was the same thing in Gaza. At the end, you know, I'm going to be faithful to the facts because I don't fear the facts. My credo in life is I never quarrel with facts. By the end, yes, the people were broken. Their spirits were broken, and now they dread the prospect of another attack. And Hamas is very careful. Hamas is effectively not playing the role of the Palestinian Authority. Right. It's policing Gaza to make sure there are no attacks from inside Gaza, because they know another attack, first of all, it's a disaster for them, but the people don't want it. But so long as the people want it, I support it 100%. They have the right to resist that Mongol army.
No challenging the right, but again, the question is...
It's not politically expedient. It's not politically prudent. I have no doubt about that. But I will never tell a person in Gaza, you don't have the right.
Fair enough.
I won't ever tell them that.
If the people of
Gaza... When I hear you tell Jews they don't have the right to use, you know, maybe for all I know, the Warsaw Ghetto, they were using indiscriminate weapons. Who the hell knows and who the hell cares?
They would have every right too. The question is only, I have to repeat myself. Mm-hmm. If Palestinians had been given a choice back in 2014, hey, do you want us to fire rockets back, or should we try to organize under these horrible conditions some sort of mass civil resistance?
I wish they did. It wasn't at that point in time an option.
Okay.
It's not so easy.
Is it even a moral thing?
It's not so easy to do those things.
Exactly. So
and the people don't believe in it. I talk to them all the time about it.
Yeah.
Every time. And they don't want to hear from me. Whenever I talk about international law, even though, you know, we're separated by thousands of miles, I could see the eyes rolling.
Right.
This guy's talking to me about international law. We've had a blockade here for 12 years. Nothing gets in, nothing goes out. He's talking to me about international law. How about if he had to give his children water that's poisoned? As Sarah Roy wrote, the children of Gaza are being poisoned every day. 95% of the drinking water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. Is that international law? He's lecturing me about international law? No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going there. I'm going to be lecturing them about the law. I try, to be honest, I do. But I can understand. It's not just skepticism. It's disgust. It's disgust.
So as Westerners, it's not our place to even ask the question that I raised, whether or not...
It's not our place to tell them.
Right, not our place to tell them, but do we even have the right? Is it even moral to ask the question, given the fact that we're not living under
occupation? I tell them all the time. I mean, I say it all the time. I don't give orders, but I say it's not working. It's a myth, you know? And I'm with Amilcar Cabral. He was the head of the liberation movement in the tiny little place, which nobody ever heard of anymore, called Guinea-Bissau. And he once gave a speech, and the speech came to be titled, Tell No Lies, Claim No Easy Victories. And I'm not going to tell lies. There are no rockets. Hamas churns out all of these videos of people with rockets. Everybody believes it. It's all theater.
We'll leave it there. Join us in the next part. The book is Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. The author is Norman Finkelstein.
Now, let us begin with the modern period of, I guess we could start with 1956 for our generation. This was the beginning of the rise of Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King decided that in Montgomery, Alabama, black people had to pay the same prices on the buses as did white people, but we had to sit in the back. And we could only sit in the back if every available seat was taken by a white person. If a white person was standing, a black person could not sit. So Dr. King and his associates got together and said, "This is inhuman. We will boycott your bus system." Now understand what a boycott is. A boycott is a passive act. It is the most passive political act that anyone can commit, a boycott. Because what the boycott was doing was simply saying, we will not ride your buses. no sort of antagonism. He was not even verbally violent. He was peaceful. Dr. King's policy was that nonviolence would achieve the gains for black people in the United States. His major assumption was that if you are nonviolent, if you suffer, your opponent will see your suffering and will be moved to change his heart. That's very good. He only made one fallacious assumption. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none. Has none.
Second time today, everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say. I
some son of a bitch would die.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM radio.
If you had the opportunity to save a life, would you take it? Sounds like a no-brainer, right? And yet only 31% of people in Ontario have registered their consent to donate their organs and tissue in the event of their death. That means, on average, one person will die every 3 days because an organ is not available to save them. By registering, you have the opportunity to save as many as 8 people's lives through organ donation and to improve the quality of life for up to 75 people through tissue donation. If you want to become a donor, go to beadonor.ca. Take 2 minutes to register your consent to save a life. And don't forget to share your wishes with your family afterwards. In the words of Mike Willis, a very grateful heart recipient,
"If someone hadn't registered their consent to donate, I would not be alive today."
Are you interested in rock and roll's impact on the world? Tune in Fridays at noon to CFRU 93.3 FM for Power Up with Electrified Voltage. For rock and vibes from around the world, tune in to hear us rock the nations.
Do you have questions about sexual health strategies? Do you want to know your HIV STI status and get tested? Every Wednesday, HIV AIDS Resources and Community Health offers free HIV STI testing that is anonymous and confidential. You don't need an appointment. They screen for HIV, syphilis, and gonorrhea, and depending on the risk factors and results, they can book follow-up appointments for other tests. If your HIV test is negative, you will know within just 20 minutes. If it is positive, they will conduct another test just to be certain. Come check them out at their accessible location at Speedvale in Dawson, or get more info at archguelph.ca/testing.
So you're listening to Back in the USSR. So before the break, we of course had Norman Finkelstein, Jewish American scholar, talking about the situation in Gaza and the Palestinians' right, and by extension, any colonized people's right to resist by any means necessary, including armed force. And he vigorously defended that, even though, of course, he did say that armed force was not effective. And, of course, I took a few issues with that. I mean, I have... First of all, I should say, we had Bruce Coburn, Canadian singer Bruce Coburn, with "If I Had a Rocket Launcher." Which, of course, it's a song about, in many ways, about anti-colonial resistance from the 1980s. And I should also say that we also heard from Stokely Carmichael, African-American, member of the African-American liberation struggle in the 1960s, talking about basically how, you know, there's a lot of glorification of nonviolence, but at the same time, for nonviolence to work, your opponent has to have a conscience. If the colonial force you are struggling against does not have a conscience, you know, nonviolence will not work on them. And it certainly seems that way with regard to the Israeli apartheid regime and what it is doing to Palestinian people. It does not care if the Palestinians engage in nonviolence. If they engage in nonviolent protests, they will kill and arrest and brutalize them anyway. And, you know, it must, of course, be said that in 2014, one of the things that prevented the Israelis from truly devastating Gaza, like launching a ground invasion to destroy Palestinian resistance in Gaza outright, the last time they invaded the Gaza Strip, was the intense armed resistance in, you know, urban combat, armed resistance, urban warfare against the Israelis. The Israelis started to take casualties and they backed off. They retreated. They knew that they would take unacceptable losses if they continued to storm Gaza. So therefore they retreated. Armed resistance, armed self-defense did in fact work in that sense. It imposed unacceptable costs on the